All callers and guests come to you courtesy of the Fire Wings Hotline. Try one of their delicious 21 flavors of wings today. Fire Wings, just wing it. And as mentioned, good to have the head coach of the Sacramento Kings on, Dave Yeager. Good afternoon, Dave. How are you?
I am well. How are you guys?
We're doing good. I guess with six preseason games, you have goals and things that you want to try to accomplish from game to game. Were you able to get some of the things done last night that you were looking to?
Well, I think the first one, you just try to get out there and get guys. I'm more concerned about just getting the minutes for guys and, you know, groups that have played together a little bit in training camp, albeit it was only six days or so, and get them out there, get them all running up and down, get that first game out of the way. We had some guys who are playing in their first professional game. I think that's very positive to get that done for Harry Giles, and what a long road he's had, and to see him out there is fantastic. And then Marvin Bagley as well. So I thought it was a positive night, no matter what the score came out to be.
Coach, I loved the interaction. As I got the ability to sit courtside, there was a sequence where you're yelling at Harry. I think it was a pick and roll. You want him to roll. He pops. He shoots a jumper. You immediately call timeout. You call him in. But you come out of the timeout, Coach, and you call a play for him. Just tell me what went on, because he knocks down a three-pointer. You look at him. He looks at you. You guys are laughing. It was beautiful to see a young player. I've been in that position before, for you to show trust and confidence in him.
I didn't know that happened. Sorry. You weren't supposed to put that out there, brother.
My bad. I apologize. That was beautiful, though, man. It doesn't get any better than that.
I think that's the stuff people don't see or get to realize very often. But, yeah, I mean, I hadn't got after a dude probably that hard in about 2 years. And I went after him pretty good, and he missed an assignment and his responsibilities of what he was supposed to do offensively. And, you know, it's kind of his honeymoon, his first game out there and all this and that, you know. But then we, after the timeout, I drew up a play, and I was like, you know what, if you want to shoot this three, since you wanted to shoot it on that one, this will be kind of ironic. I'm going to draw you up a play. You're going to shoot this three right here.
That's awesome.
And so, he put his hands up. He was celebrating. We're laughing back and forth because, you know, that stuff is out there. It's competitive, and you – well, everybody's trying to do the best they can, but I wanted to show confidence in him.
Yeah,
that I've got his back. Hey, just because you make a mistake one time, that doesn't mean, you know, you're a bad person. I'm bad. You move on, and he drilled that joker too.
Yeah, he did. And,
it was good for him and good for us, and a fun part of the journey that we're all on.
Dave, one thing that's very obvious last night, we've heard you talk about it in training camp, but this team's going to get the ball and they're going to go. And they're going to go up tempo, and you're going to push the ball and push the ball. And with that, sometimes can come turnovers. And I thought for the first game, you know, I thought it was better than I was expecting. But can you talk about that fine line? And is there a number that you can live with turnover per game? Talk about that ratio and what you expect from your team when you're going up tempo most of the game.
Yeah, I think we're trying to – if you're making aggressive errors, I think that's where you're putting a lot of force on the other team around the basket. I think I can live with those. I don't have a specific number in mind, but it's also who makes the mistake. I'm totally fine with De'Aaron Fox having 29 turnovers, going 100 miles an hour, trying to force tempo and get in a lane versus some other guys trying to make some pretty little cross-court bounce passes. So – I think De'Aaron's charge is to for everybody to run and get away from him, so that we always say it's all five guys takes to run, and not just De'Aaron pushing the basketball, because you want to give him space, and ultimately you're going to be the one rewarded for doing that. I feel like, you know, every time down the floor he should just look, and I know what Westbrook does this, is to see, hey, can I just beat this one dude right here? If I beat this one dude right here, can I get all the way to the rim? Mm-hmm. And if he has that mindset, I think he did that a little bit last night. After a made shot, and we want him to put that much pressure on the rim, and that's going to benefit a lot of our players for spot-up threes, and then, you know, just creates penetration and all kinds of things.
Coach, how long do you think it takes them to realize exactly what you just said? Because that first wave that he pushes, it flattens the defense out. The second wave of offensive players, they're going to get free shots. They're going to get wide open looks, drives to the basket. Is that something that it'll take maybe the preseason? How long do you see that before they start to realize?
It's an evolution of learning how to play together, maybe a year and a half. I mean, you know, where guys learn to get away. Maybe there's times where you let him drive right at your guy and you actually go behind him and get yourself an open three. It's kind of a European kind of deal.
Yes.
And then where do your bigs play? And we kind of haven't settled in. And that's why I'm not trying to be a smart aleck about how long it would take. When you get a rotation, as you know, of guys where you get settled in and you play together for a period of time, you kind of know where each other is going to be. And we've got so many young guys, they're just trying to figure out where they're supposed to be on the court, let alone where to play with each other. So I it's going to be fun to watch it all kind of come together as what do our bigs turn out to be? We're going to play two power bigs. And what does the spacing look like on that? Or, you know, can we find a way to play a stretch guy in there somewhere, you know, in the future and create more space and more threes in transition? Because to me, those are the best ones. You put a lot of pressure on the defense first 3-4 seconds of the clock, and guys get to walk in with their momentum going forward into a 3-point shot. I love that.
Dave, any idea as we speak right now whether Bielitsa will be available for the next two games? And for the fans listening that don't know a lot about him other than watching him when the Kings played Minnesota, what have you seen from him in training camp that you've liked?
Oh, I absolutely love him. I've enjoyed him, watching him for years. Can torture you a little bit. When he's surrounded himself with playmakers and guys that he can play off of, he can really stretch the four as a stretch four. You know, and I think when I'm watching these preseason games and I'm watching Al-Farouq Aminu, who's been a small forward his whole career, start at power forward for Portland, or Toronto started the other night with C.J. Miles, who came into the league as a shooting guard. He's starting at power forward. It's not even guys that are, you know, we start traditional and then you get a stretch four. Now, you know, like a Dario Saric starting at four for Philadelphia, he's a stretch four. We're just, the league is just skipping it and going straight to, you know what, we're just going to play small forwards at power forward. And it's four guys, four perimeter skill guys around, you know, with a heck of a playmaker and point guards. And there's a lot of them, and Kyle Lowry and Damian Lillard. And those are the games that I was watching. And, you know, Boston did the same thing with Kyrie. They're playing Jason Tatum. He's a three. They're playing him at power forward. So the game has changed, and there's lots of space. And so, to your point, you know, a guy like Bielitsa is I'm just going to always probably call him Belly, because I'm going to butcher his name all season long so poorly. Right. But we just get Belly out there and get him healthy. I know he's in shape, Grant, because, you know, he worked hard for his national team and played in those games. And those guys don't play around overseas. They, you know, go through their two-a-days and stuff. So I know he's in shape. He's looked great. He gives De'Aaron a lot of space to play. His team won a lot of the games last week, for sure.
Coach, as you I want to say it was a first and a third. I don't think I looked at second and fourth. But each time, Kings in a penalty with about 3 minutes to go. And if I'm knowing you, you don't necessarily tell them. Maybe you show them with tape. They didn't take advantage of the penalty, meaning that settling for jump shots, turnovers, things like that. How do you show them that, guys, this is how we win ball games? 3 minutes left in a quarter, we're in the penalty. We have to force and force our will on the team and get to the free throw line.
That's a good question, Neil. Okay, you just got to keep emphasizing it, and you know, there's a lot that's thrown at them, but generally, your guys that have more experience and more clout in the league are going to be able to go in and take a guy and try to draw a foul one-on-one. So, you know, as our guys get better and older and more experienced, more physical, you know, we looked out there last night and it was like, holy, this guy needs to add 20 pounds. This guy needs to add 20 pounds. And it just their young bodies. And, you know, there was times where, you know, they were just too big for us and physically kind of manhandled us. But as we, you know, we'll take our lumps, but we're going to keep working, and we'll be giving them out before them.
Dave, during this period of time where you don't have Bogdan Bogdanovic, what are you looking for when De'Aaron Fox is not on the floor? Obviously, last night it was a tremendous game for Yogi Ferrell. You played Frank a lot. How does that work itself out as we get to opening day?
Well, yeah, it's going to be very difficult. We're going to play De'Aaron a lot of minutes. And so for the, you know, the times that he's not out there, you try to play, you know, maybe a couple of playmakers or play smaller. But it's also an opportunity that for Marvin and Harry, guys that can take a guy and go at the elbow and go at people or go down in the post. And and try to go at people. And so, you know, you have that dynamic as well.
I don't know what we call it. I looked up and I seen Marvin, Scow, Willie. There was another one out there and I just went, this is the King of Kings lineup, the death lineup. I don't know, coach. Did you put them in there and just said, go get it? I think they matched up with Frank Mason was the only guard.
Yeah, it was like our 4-7s group. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's something that I wanted to see. We got a lot of guys that need to play and need to be developed. And so it's how we're made a little bit and give those guys opportunities to get minutes. Just is going to be what it is. So, you know, it's an opportunity. They're so young, we didn't really realize that defensively we were just fine. We took a bad foul. But by and large, you just keep people in front of you and you make them shoot over the top of you.
Yep.
And we did that by and large. Offensively, we hadn't seen that before. So, okay, of the four of you, at least one of you is going to have a really bad mismatch. That dude just needs to go down and run and stand in the paint. And they couldn't figure out
who it was.
Yeah, right. Like, here, you know that's you. Don't go out on the perimeter because you got a little guy on you going to paint. So it was a learning experience.
That's awesome.
We're going to see it again, without a doubt, just to be able to play a lot of those guys' minutes.
Dave, we'll see you in L.A. Thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. We'll see you next
Thursday. I love it. You guys fired up. The season is here, man. Let's get it going.
Yes. We're fired up, too. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Thanks, buddy.
All right. Good stuff right there. And, again, you know, he just said he wanted to get guys minutes. He wanted to see Marvin Bagley and Harry Giles play their first game, get that out of the way. I mean, you know, you can't just overlook that. I mean, now you move on to, you got it? All right, you got your feet wet. Now let's go.
Yeah. Grant, were you surprised? I don't know. I was looking down at my phone or something, and I looked up, and I see Frank Mason with the ball, and then I see Bagley, Giles, Willie Cauley-Stein, and Scal. And I just went, oh, my goodness, man. And listening to Coach, the defensive part of it, listen, keep a guy in front of you. You got plenty of space because you're so long. Contest the shot. And then figure out mismatches. That's what the game's about. That's the IQ part of basketball that Coach is trying to teach them. But that was a big lineup.
Yeah, and again, in preseason, that's what you do. You experiment, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you try to figure out, okay, well, what could I do this? Could I do that? And, you know, he's not really worried too much right now about whether it works or not. He just wants to experiment and see what you know, for the future. Could I do this? Okay, I can't do that. All right, let me try this. Let me try that. That's what preseason is for.
You know what, Grant? And by you saying that, it flashes back because Coach Adelman, I remember when I first got here, he was like, can you play point guard? And I said, yeah, I can play point guard. And we were playing against the Portland Trailblazers in the preseason game. And I want to say he put me in at the point guard, but he put somebody else in. I can't remember. It was a bigger lineup. He put me in the post, got some free throws and different things. Those are the type of experiments that you use because it's not necessarily, Grant, that you're going to play that way. It's that in spot minutes you can play that way if these guys understand and they play well together and there's something that you can take advantage of in the game. And with that type of size, you can take advantage of some things.
All right. If you want to call the show, 339-1140. That's 339-1140, 800-920-1140. We have got the rest of this show to talk about the NFL, the A's, and the Yankees tomorrow as the Cubs and the Brewers are underway at Wrigley. The Cubs and the Rockies are underway. The winner moves on. The loser is done for the year, and that will be the same scenario tomorrow with the Yankees and the A's. So give us a shout at 339-1140, 800-920-1140. Again, 339-1140 and 800-920-1140.
Lester on the bump, top of the first, man now on second and third. The ivy in the wall as Chicago comes into play. Grant, a ball gets lost. I believe you call that a ground rule double.
Yeah, and the Cubs, that run should have scored.
The runner
would have been able to walk home on it or crawl home on his hands and knees. And they're going to have a discussion with the crew to see whether or not the runner who was moving on the pitch from first will be allowed to home, and they said no. So second and third. Now, while we'll keep you up to date on that, of course, we'll have tomorrow's game for you right here on Sports 1140 KHTK. Interesting what Dave Yeager said about the power forward position and where it's going in the NBA, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. When you Al-Farouq Aminu is a great example that Coach Yeager used. He's probably about 6'8", right in there. But, you know, he's got the kind of ability to stretch the floor, but he's been a three, and he's normally a three. And you're seeing that a lot of times from teams now. The Golden State Warriors, Grant, used what they called their death lineup, and that was Draymond at the four, or, you know, KD and Iguodala. Those are the type of lineups that if you can get away with that, and if the Kings can do that with the bigger guys that can stay in front of these guys, it might play into the Kings' hands, because now teams are playing kind of that 6-6, 6-7 across the board type of lineup.
What do you think that means for the game of basketball from an entertainment perspective, from a TV ratings, from a fan's perspective? Is that going to be something that fans are going to go, yeah, give me more of that because I want to see more points, where the post game continues to become less and less of an emphasis based on what we have seen when you played to where we are now?
You know, everything is cyclical, Grant. It will come back. Last night we see a guy like DeAndre Ayton. Look, if he's dominant in the post, you're going to have to figure out a way to stop him. The problem is we haven't seen really dominant post players. And because that's now everything is skillful, stepping outside, shooting jumpers and different things like that. I think that the game with the smaller guys, it's going to be entertaining because, first of all, they move really well. They get up and down the court. They're high flyers. You're shooting a lot of threes. You got the dribble moves, the different things like that. So to the eye, it's going to be definitely entertaining. It's going to be, when you have a post player that can be dominant, you're going to use them. And that'll be kind of a specialty that other teams don't have.
All right, are you going to use him? All right, I'm going to use you. I'm going to give you a couple examples.
Okay.
Here. All right, Joel Embiid, DeMarcus Cousins. How many threes do they shoot every year? And they're tremendous post players, and yet very often they're spending the time from the 3-point line to the elbow, and many times outside the 3-point line.
And this is what you got to do. You have to show them a winning recipe with using their talents to the benefit of the team. Otherwise, and we always talk about this, Grant, where does change come? Change comes at the youth level. And right now, the youth level isn't emphasizing footwork and post play and things like that. It's emphasizing running up, shooting a three-pointer. It doesn't matter if you're 6'2 or if you're 6'10. So what you got to do is you got to show them, I'm going to allow you to shoot some threes. I'm going to allow you to grab the ball and bring it up in transition, even if you're Joel Embiid or DeMarcus Cousins. And you can shoot the basketball, but I need probably a 3-to-1 ratio, or maybe even 50-50, that you shoot your three, but I want you to also get the ball at the elbow, put it on the deck, and punish somebody. Also, get it in the post, punish them, cause a double team, kick it out, and allow your teammates to feast.
Yeah, good luck with that. 339-1140, 800-920-1140. Again, 339-1140, 800-920-1140. You talk about this all the time, and it's why when you played in Sacramento, your team every year had success, because guys bought into their roles.
Yes.
And they understood what they were good at and what they weren't good at. Mm-hmm. And they also understood that maybe if they were good in an area, the guy next to them was better, and they were okay moving the ball. And you know what? That's not always easy to accomplish. It's easier said than done. You have to have the right personalities to make that work.
And that's why, Grant, there's only a few teams in the NBA that win right now. That's just simple and plain. So, yeah, you can keep banging your head against a wall and taking L's, or you can begin to learn how to play as a team. And you know why it's even more evident today? The only way that you're going to compete against a team like the Golden State Warriors is to have a deeper team. They have 4 or 5 players right now that are top shelf, but they fall off at the bench level. If you have a team that can compete and your team is deep, meaning 9-10 deep on the bench, well, now you have a chance against them. Otherwise, you're going to get your stats, you're going to get your money, but you're going to take a whole bunch of L's.
Let's get to Kyle on with Grant and Doug. Hi, Kyle.
How you doing, Grant?
What's up?
Hey, I was going to call and talk about the A's and the Yankees game. Do you think that the Yankees could possibly regret starting Serviano on the mound against the A's? His last start wasn't very well against them in New York.
Well, that was it was in Oakland. His last start was in Oakland.
Oh, it
New
was
York.
In Oakland?
And
okay.
It was the game on the second game of that 3-game set where Sanchez had 2 pass balls and two wild pitches by Severino. So if that happens, it's going to be a disaster for the Yankees. But I'm a little surprised I would have gone with Hap. But to me, I said this to Doug, the most important inning for Luis Severino tomorrow is going to be the first because, you know, he started last year's first playoff game and got tattooed. The Yankees came back and won the game. But that's he's got to get past the first inning. And I think if he does, I think he'll pitch a very strong game. He is a very good pitcher. He has just been inconsistent lately, and that's why I would not have started him. If I'm looking at this from a Yankees perspective, I would have started J. Happ.
Yeah, as Severino, you know, his fastball, he's got good command, but if his command isn't there in the first inning, like you said, he doesn't seem to settle in the second and the third. And the A's, you know, if they get to him, that's the team that could really destroy him in the first three innings, and that's not something that the Yankees really want. Do you think that they should have someone in the bullpen ready, like another starter, like Hap, or like maybe Lance Lynn or someone like that?
Everyone's ready. Every single guy that puts on their uniform tomorrow is ready to play because there is no tomorrow. So it doesn't matter who you are. You got to be ready to play. And what happens if the game goes 15 innings? What happens if it's, you know, a marathon?
Oh, yeah. I totally understand that.
The managers are going to manage this game differently than any other game they've been in this year because of the fact that you cannot, like I'll tell you, John Lester started the game tonight for the Cubs. He was very close, all right, to being on the ledge where you had to take him out. Now, he got out of the inning, luckily, with only giving up one run, but they hit him hard. And I can tell you right now, there's no way Joe Maddon could have left him in much longer with the way
he's very walk prone too, because the Rockies are very, very. They don't strike out that much, and then if Lester gets wild, you know, the Rockies could win it in the first three.
Short hook, Grant. If he comes back out in the second inning and gives up a base hit, he's out of there.
Yep. All right.
So both managers, you know, listen. Both these teams have tremendous bullpens. Okay. The question is, at what point? Because I know that Bob Melvin's going to do it. He's going to do it very quickly. At what point does Aaron Boone say, you know what, I can't leave Louis in anymore. I got to get him out. Because Bob Melvin, we already know what he's going to do. We don't know how Aaron Boone's going to manage this game tomorrow. That's going to
exactly.
be the real key.
Exactly. All right, well, all right, you guys have a good one. I got to say it. Go
too.
A's.
Well, hey, you know what? It should be a dandy of a game. It should be a dandy. We'll be right back. This is Sports 1140 KHDK. Grant Napier, Doug Christie, we open up the phone lines at 339-1140, 800-920-1140, NBA game one of six in the preseason in the books for Sacramento. And we talk about everything else that's going on this busy, busy calendar, and it has been crazy as we started off this week. I mean, if you don't have enough stuff going on now, then I don't know what to say. I really don't. All right. There is a new book out by Ian O'Connor. He is the author of Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Coach of All Time. And he now joins us right here on Sports 1140 KHTK. Thanks very much for coming on. It's Grant Napier and Doug Christie. How are you today, Ian?
How are you, gentlemen? Thanks for having me on.
You know, I've listened to you do some other interviews, and I'm just curious what the reaction has been. Is there a general consensus to what people have read in your book where they're like, wow, I can't believe that? Is there one thing that stands out above the rest that you have found when people read this book?
Well, a lot of people have focused on an anonymous quote from an assistant talking about how the system has elevated Brady. And if you gave us, this is from an anonymous Patriots assistant, if you gave us any of the top 15 quarterbacks in the league, we can win at a high level with those players. And what's kind of been lost in translation is that quote came from a period of time before the Patriots drafted Jimmy Garoppolo, where Brady was starting to struggle. He was showing signs of decline, and there was concern in that organization. So we're talking around 2013 that the age was starting to take a toll on Brady, and he was not the player. He didn't have the same – he had three rings. He hadn't won since 2004. So his stature in the league was good, very good, but it wasn't what it is today. And so there's been a lot of conversation about that quote, and do the Patriot coaching staff, do they sort of have the same, do they attach the same value to Brady that people around the league do? And Tom was just a different figure back then. I think today, if you ask the coaches and put them on truth serum, they would say, hey, he is the greatest quarterback of all time, and the system might have elevated him, but Tom's really special.
Ian, when you look at Belichick, you researched him, you looked at all aspects. In your opinion, what makes him? What's that one ingredient? Is it turning over every stone, not leaving a stone unturned, preparation, the ability to identify talent? What makes him so special?
Well, he needed a special player to make this happen. And so he got a little lucky, but they did draft Tom Brady and nobody else did. It was the 199th pick, and he was the seventh player the Patriots took in that draft. And so you have to start there, but Belichick just outworks people. Yeah. And I know most people in the NFL do work very hard, but he logs more hours than anyone. His attention to detail is just through the roof. He practices situational football more than anyone in the league. And special teams, and every coach from Pop Warner on up talks about the importance of special teams and that it's just as vital as offense and defense. Well, Bill actually means it. He lives it. So, but without Brady, this dynasty could not have been possible. And I don't really subtract that from Belichick's legacy. As you know, Doug, you played in the NBA, what, 15 years?
Yep.
Every great coach, whether it's Phil Jackson, Popovich, they had to have a great player at the center of it. And Belichick found a great player. And without that, things would have been different. But that's okay. He needed a vehicle for his greatness, and he found one.
Ian joins us courtesy of the Fire Wings Hotline. Try one of their delicious 21 flavors of wings today. Fire Wings, just wing. All right. The bottom line is the Patriots every year seem like they're playing for all the marbles. And, you know, you get to February, and, gee, it's the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl. And then as of late, you've heard, well, you know, Tom doesn't like this, or this doesn't like that, or this, there's a problem here, there's a problem there. At the end of the day, does that even matter? With that, because it doesn't seem to affect their success on the field.
Yeah, it's you're right, Grant, and we've seen in other sports, too, where people don't get along and they win. The Steinbrenner Yankees, I covered them a lot in New York. There was always conflict internally, and yet they won. You look at Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson. They didn't even speak to Jerry Krause for years. They couldn't stand him. He put the whole thing together, but they won, so nobody cares. I think basically the Patriots, the Belichick-Brady relationship for 17, 18 years was always transactional. There was no love and warmth between those two. They never went out to dinner, ever, not even once. But it worked, and that's all anybody cared about. Last year was the first time where there was a fracture in the relationship that came into public view. I think it's almost amazing it took 17, 18 years for that to happen. But I will say this, the sources I talked to, and I wrote this in the book, as late March, Brady was thinking of walking away rather than playing for Belichick one more time. That relationship was broken. They got through it barely. And Brady did ultimately come back after boycotting OTAs. He was the only starting quarterback who didn't show up. And I think they're okay now. It's functioning. And I think they had to survive one meltdown in their partnership, and they survived it, and now they move on.
What in your mind made Tom come back or allowed him to come back? Did they ever sit down, have a conversation, or is there just an understanding in two great minds that they put it under the table and they just work together?
Well, I think it was more a case of Brady realizing, if I walk away, this fan base that adores me, and he's iconic, obviously, in New England, is going to turn on me, because he had talked, including a long interview I had with him for a number of years, about playing until at least 45. And when I spoke with him in March of 2017 on the phone, we were talking about 46, 47, 48.
Wow.
So he had said that more than once. Also, he compelled the organization to trade his successor.
Yes.
So if he walked out the door, asked for his release, or retired, they would have felt like, how could you do that to us after what you said? And after basically, I'm not going to say forcing the organization to trade Jimmy G, but his play and also his feelings really compelled Robert Kraft to make it clear to Belichick that Tom Brady is staying. He is not going to get traded. So if somebody has to go, then obviously it's not going to be Tom. So I think that is what brought him back more than anything else.
We're talking with Ian O'Connor, author of Belichick, The Making of the Greatest Coach of All Time. And arm strength notwithstanding, with the way the game's being called now and the emphasis to protect the quarterbacks, we may see a lot of guys that play the quarterback position playing into the 40s.
Yeah, you're right. I think that it's as long as you have a good offensive line, you know, Brady, it's funny. He's more athletic now than he was when he was 30. He moves better. I don't know if it's his diet, his fitness regimen, his trainer, Alex Guerrero, who, of course, was at the center of a lot of the controversy last year. But Brady, to me, moves better than he did at age 30, 31. And he's athletic in his own way. His feet are good in the pocket. Obviously, he's not going to run. He's not going to take off and gain a lot of first downs with his legs. But he can extend the play a little bit inside the pocket. And as long as he can get protected, his receivers are good at getting separation quickly in tight spaces. I think he can last a long time. And I even said to him, why not 50? At some point, a great American athlete in team sports will play to age 50 at a fairly high level. Who says it's not Tom Brady? And he didn't say no to that. So wow. I think he's got a lot of years left, and I think Belichick's going to coach for at least another 4 or 5 years as well.
Ian, is there a Patriot way? And the reason that I ask that is it looks like Belichick and the owner stepping away, allowing Belichick to run things, do it his way, the Patriot way. And all of a sudden now, this is the first chink in the armor that we've seen maybe where Tom supersedes and goes to the owner. In your mind, as through all this research, do you think there is a Patriot way?
I do. I think it's still intact. It was tested like never before last year with the conflict. But look at the Patriot way in San Antonio with the Spurs, and they had the same thing, right,
yeah.
with Kawhi Leonard.
Yep.
It's interesting. We thought that Popovich and Belichick would never have to deal with this.
Yes.
And they both dealt with it in the same year. But I think the Patriot way is about accountability. And Dante Stallworth told me a story in 2007. He was sitting next to Randy Moss in the first team meeting that year in preseason. And Belichick was just lighting up Tom Brady in front of the whole team about mistakes he made in the previous year's AFC Championship game loss to the Colts, just killing him in front of the whole team. And Moss and Stallworth looked at each other like, oh, my God, if he is doing this to Tom Brady, that means we all have to sort of live up to that standard of accountability. And I think that was true. The Patriots, from the top of the roster to the bottom, they saw the way he coached Brady and everyone else who was a very important player, and everyone fell in line. And that was a big part of the Patriot way, where nobody's bigger than the system, including the greatest quarterback of all time.
Ian, if you don't mind, I want to switch gears for a minute, because I know that you spent a lot of time when you wrote the book involving the rivalry between Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, and it was a bestseller. And after what we witnessed at the Ryder Cup this weekend, and then the subsequent stories after the Ryder Cup, and who knows whether they're true or not, about the rift between Reed and Spieth, and then apparently, you know, Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson having an altercation. You know, we talk about rivalries in golf. We were always waiting for someone to be the rival of Tiger Woods, and now they're having a made for, I guess, a paid event with Phil and Tiger, which we never really saw them play on the back nine at a major where we had that rivalry. First of all, what's your take on what we saw from the Americans at the Ryder Cup this weekend? How embarrassing was that?
Yeah, it just... the aftermath, their play was embarrassing, I thought, to begin with. I don't think Phil Mickelson ever belonged on that team with his age and the way he played for most of the summer. And I think the Americans are too worried about hurt feelings, and it seems like the Europeans go for blood and go for the kill much more so than we do. And so I never would have split up Jordan Spieth and Patrick Reed. I don't care that they don't like each other. We just brought that up. And it doesn't matter if you don't like each other. As long as you win, that's all that counts. And those guys won together. That was a dumb idea by Jim Furyk to break that group up. And then you saw what happened to Patrick Reed. He was catatonic out there practically. And I actually thought Tiger played a whole lot better than Phil Mickelson, and certainly when he was paired with Reed, he played better than him. Tiger took a lot of heat for not winning, but I didn't think he was the weakest link there. Bubba Watson, Phil, and Furyk, I think, just some of the decisions he made. And then the aftermath, you just, when the Europeans lose, you don't see that happen.
Right.
They just seem more cohesive, and you don't see all these disputes breaking out. And, of course, Mickelson versus Tom Watson the last time around that when we lost in Europe and now this. It's unbecoming, and it does explain why Europe is more successful in this event than we are.
Ian, appreciate it. Thanks very much for coming on and sharing about the book, and we hope that we can talk to you in the not-too-distant future. Again, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, we appreciate it. We'll be right back on Sports 1140 KHDK. Yankees and A's tomorrow. We'll have it for you right here on Sports 1140 KHTK. Doug, you'll be flying down with the team to L.A. tomorrow. I'll meet you there on Thursday. So give me your thoughts on the A's. Yanks, how's this game going to go?
Man, obviously pitcher by committing. You're starting with Liam Hendricks and your Yanks with Luis Severino. Grant, if he gets out, meaning Luis, out of the first inning and he has a good first inning, I think that you guys are going to be okay. If the A's get to him, and I mean, not necessarily a run, Grant, but you know, you were just talking about the ability to hit the ball hard. If you're seeing them hitting the ball hard, it could be a long night. It's hard for me to go against the A's here, but I'm going to go with home field. I think that the Yanks figure out a way to get this one. It's tough for me to say that because this is an A's team, Grant, that I actually think can go to the Yanks and win.
Oh, I do too. I think the biggest difference between these two teams is the defense, and we talked about it with Ray Fosse yesterday, behind the plate and at third base, and the Yankees are not strong behind the plate. As a matter of fact, it's a real weak spot. Now, they do have Austin Romine they can insert in, but, you know, and I would have started him personally, but the other weakness is, you know, Miguel Andujar at third, a very good player, very good at the bat, but is a little erratic in the field. And if the game is tight in the later innings, you'll see Aaron Boone take him out and go defense there at that juncture. So keep an eye on that. The defense in this game, to me, I give the edge to the A's. Defensively, they're a better defensive team than the Yankees.
So am I hearing you go with the A's?
No, I think the Yankees win because I think they're a better overall team from top to bottom. I mean, they have a better lineup. I don't think that their bullpen is better, but I think that their pitching is better. In other words, I think when you take Severino, Tanaka, and Happ, and then you take the other players in their bullpen, I think from top to bottom, their pitching staff is better. I don't think their bullpen is better, but I think you're going to see starters come in instead of the bullpen if Severino is not able to go very deep into the game. So, you know, I think the Yankees are a better team,
yes.
Period. And when they're healthy, I think they are not a much better team. They're a little bit better when they're healthy. And right now they're healthy, and being at home doesn't hurt. I don't know if it's that big of an advantage, but it's a small advantage because you get to – you always have your last licks, and you know what you have to do. And so what that means is, let's say you're down by a run and you get your leadoff man on. All right, you're going to move that runner over to second, whereas in the third inning, you're not going to do that, okay?
Uh-huh.
Whereas in the fifth inning, you're not going to do that in all – in the seventh, but in the ninth inning, you do that. So, you know, again, you know what you got to do, and I think that's a little bit of an advantage, obviously, when you're at home. But – I think this is almost, not quite, almost about as close as it can be to a toss-up game as there is.
Grant, is there anything in you that, as I look at the Colorado Rockies and the Chicago Cubs, Colorado up 1-0 in the bottom of the second with the man on first, the Cubbies with the man on first, is there anything in you that says the first team to put a mark on the board may have an advantage in this game as things get maybe a little tight, or are you still staying with whoever's leading after five?
Yeah, I think whoever's leading after five. I mean, the Yankees have proven all year, particularly at home. And Severino, by the way, at home has been dynamite this year. I mean, mm-hmm. That's the other thing about Severino. He has pitched very well at the stadium. You know, it's very hard to comprehend the Yankees not scoring a couple of runs tomorrow. All right? It just is with their lineup. And conversely, I mean, the A's lineup is very good too. But I'm having a difficult time thinking that the entire Yankees lineup is going to struggle tomorrow. I just, again, they're all healthy. You know, we don't even talk about a guy like Brett Gardner. He normally comes up huge in these type of games. So Don't forget about him because everybody's talking about Stanton and Judge and Gregorius. Keep an eye on Brett Gardner. He always seems to come up very big in these games.
Yeah, it's normally that guy that they end up having to pitch to because they're trying to avoid your Judges and guys like that, that those guys get an opportunity. Any chance that Mr. Sanchez steps up and takes something deep or comes up with...
Yeah, no, that's why he's playing. If Aaron Boone didn't think so, then he would not be in the lineup because he's certainly not in the lineup for his catching, that's for sure. Hey, remember, all callers and guests appear courtesy of the Fire Wings Hotline. Try one of their delicious 21 flavors of wings today. Fire Wings, just swinging. I mean, I think the Yankees win tomorrow because I think that from top to bottom they're a better team, but they're not that much better. I mean, they're better by a whisker, and the pressure is all on the Yankees. No one's really expecting the A's to win this game. I think the A's are relishing being in Yankee Stadium. I mean, what a statement this would be for the low payroll and the small market Oakland A's to go into mighty New York and beat the Yankees. How about that? How about that narrative? Huh?
Listen, that would be the story of all stories.
Yes,
I mean,
it would.
And listen, if you do that, then you go and you got the mighty Boston Red Sox to face. I mean, this could be a story of all stories because coming into the season, not expecting a lot, you go down with two pitchers, both getting Tommy John, and then you lose Manaea, but you keep on rolling, and nobody's making excuses, and all of a sudden you find yourself on the biggest stage in baseball, yep, New York City, with the opportunity to shock everybody.
Well, the champagne's going to be flowing tomorrow night, but it's only going to be flowing in one clubhouse, so we'll see. We're going to have the game for you right here on Sports 1140 KHTK. We're looking forward to I'm going to be at the game, so I'll be able to share with you on Thursday what the experience was like. I know already what the experience is going to be like, but I don't know what's going to happen in the game. So, you know, for that reason, it's the beauty of going to sports. If you knew what was going to happen, nobody would go to the game.
Yeah, this is true. You know, Grant, we were talking earlier about relief pitchers and starting pitching and all that different stuff. Do you think that starting pitching will kind of turn into something like relief pitchers, like Mariano Rivera, a Dennis Eckersley, where only a couple teams have that really great guy? But now, if we do see a switch in things, relievers are the big thing. Not everyone has that ace, and you can go to that guy, kind of like it used to be when you guys had Mariano Rivera.
Yeah, but the Yankees also had a great setup. And when you look at most great closers, including the A's with Blake Treinen, you know, they've had, you know, Trevino pitching for a good part of the year before him. Now they went out and got, you know, Fernando Rodney and Familia. So, but my point is, you need that setup guy. What made the Yankees great during that era is they had a great setup guy in addition to Mariano Rivera. Most closers, you know, have tremendous setup guys to be able to get to the closer. So we'll see. It's going to be fun. We'll have it for you tomorrow. Again, the A's and the Yankees right here on Sports 1140 KHTK as we roll around on this Tuesday night right here on Sports 1140.